And then let's come back to a motivation of kindness and concern for the welfare of others. A wish to contribute to their benefit. And in order to do this, to progress along the path to full awakening ourselves, so that we aren't limited by our ignorance and self-centeredness, and instead are reinforced by wisdom and compassion, enabling us to really be of great benefit to others. So with that long-term perspective, then, let's listen and discuss today. The text we've been going through, we do one verse each month, is Don't Believe Everything You Think, which is based on a poem written in Tibet many centuries ago about how to train our mind to deal with difficulties in life in a useful and beneficial and realistic way. And so the verses we've covered so far have talked about how, you know, we have a very precious opportunity with our present life, and yet our life goes by very quickly. And so we should value it and value our time and not waste them, and really put our energy into doing something that will last for a long time, to have a long-term benefit, not only in this life, but as Buddhists, we think of future lives as well. In other words, the consciousness doesn't simply go out of existence at the time of death, but has its own continuity and is reborn. And so to develop our good qualities in this long-term way to be a benefit, you know, not only in this life, but also in the future. So the verse that we're on this week is about turning to the Buddhist path for spiritual guidance. I should start this off by saying Buddhism has respect for all the various religions and different spiritual paths. We have the perspective that everybody has a different way of thinking. People have different dispositions, different needs, and so it's very good that there's a multiplicity of religions so that people can find what they need. You know, if you try and make everybody believe in the same thing, it's not going to work. So we don't say our religion is the best one for everybody. We may say it's the best for me because it fulfills my needs and helps me to be a better person. But other religions are the best one for other people who have a different way of seeing things and different dispositions. So it's very open-minded in that way. Okay. So having said that, then this particular chapter is about turning to the Buddhist path for our spiritual guidance. So the verse reads, bound himself in the jail of cyclic existence, what worldly God can give you protection? Therefore, when you seek refuge, take refuge in the three jewels that will not betray you. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so what this is referring to is if we, there's an expression of taking refuge, which means to seek spiritual guidance, to follow the path of, a particular path. That's the meaning of taking refuge. If we take refuge in a spiritual path or in some kind of deity that is himself or herself or itself bound in the jail of cyclic existence, meaning under the influence of ignorance, you know, under the influence of afflicted mental states, then if we seek spiritual refuge from somebody like that, we're not going to be able to eliminate our own suffering and difficulties and reach a state of liberation, because the one we're turning for spiritual guidance to hasn't reached that state themselves. So it becomes a situation of the blind leading the blind. Okay, so it's very important to turn to spiritual guidance to somebody who is actually fully awakened, who is no longer under the sway of ignorance, no longer under the sway of mental afflictions like greed or anger or vengefulness, yeah, no longer limited by their own actions, their own polluted karma, and so forth. And so this verse says, you know, don't take refuge in somebody who's still confused, because that's not going to get you out of your own confusion and ignorance, but turn to the three jewels of refuge. So the three jewels are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So the Dharma, the second one, is the real refuge, because that's the realization of the path inside of our own mind. Yeah, that's what we're really looking for, is that realization of the nature of reality that will lead us to the cessation of all of our suffering, all of our unsatisfactory circumstances. So that Dharma, which we will actualize in the future, is the real refuge, because when we've actualized it in our own mind, then we're clear, okay? And that's it. Because we haven't actualized it in our own mind now, then we, you know, we pay respect and turn for refuge to the realization of the path and the cessation of suffering in the minds of other living beings. And so the other living beings who have that realization are called the Sangha, or the Sangha jewel, and that's referring here to anybody who has the direct perception of the nature of reality. And then the Buddha is the teacher who described that path. So it's very important to realize that the Buddha did not create the world. The Buddha did not create suffering. The Buddha didn't even create the path to enlightenment. Buddha is not a creator, okay? Rather, the Buddha started out as a human being like us, but through discovering the path and practicing it, purifying his mind of all the selfishness and ignorance, and developing all the good qualities, wisdom, compassion, generosity, and so on, then he was able to reach full awakening. And due to his great compassion, then he taught the path to others, or described the path to others. So Buddha is somebody who describes the path. He didn't create the path or invent the path. Buddha did not create the world. In fact, we say it's our own karma, our own actions above body, speech, and mind that are the force creating the world and creating the beings within it. Okay? So the Buddha is, the idea of the Buddha is very different from that of a theistic religion, which says that there's a creator. Okay? That says that's quite important to understand. So there's another analogy given about how the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are like good objects for us to turn to. And that's that when we start out regarding ourselves as a sick person. Yeah, we have problems in our life, we have difficulties, there's so much unwanted suffering. You know, we're faced with aging, sickness, and death, which we don't want. We're faced with having problems we don't want and not getting what we do want, and so on. And so we're like the as the analogy goes, we're like the patient, the sick person. So we go to the doctor, who is in the analogy is like the Buddha. Okay, so a doctor looks and then gives a diagnosis, so that you know, like what your disease is and what the cause of it is. And so the Buddha says, your disease, quote, quote, is, you know, living in cyclic existence. And the cause of it is your own internal ignorance, anger, and attachment. And all the actions that you've done motivated by these very obscured mental states. Yeah. And so having diagnosed the illness, then the doctor gives the medicine. So the Dharma is like the medicine. So the Buddha says, okay, you know, you're suffering from ignorance, anger, and attachment. Practice this to get rid of your ignorance. Practice that to get rid of your anger. Practice that to get rid of your attachment. So he describes the path that we need to practice, okay? So the path is actually a consciousness that we have to develop within us. It's not an external thing that we walk on, but it's mental states that we practice and try and develop in our mind that will overcome the unrealistic mental states that, you know, such as ignorance, anger, and attachment, that are the root of our difficulties. Okay. So the Buddha, the doctor prescribes the Dharma, the doctor prescribes the medicine, the Buddha prescribes the Dharma practice, okay? So we're the patient, now we got the medicine, yeah? So you don't just take your medicine and put it on your nightstand and leave it there, yeah? Or leave it, you know, in your medicine chest, because if you don't take the medicine, you're not going to get better. But sometimes, as patients, we don't remember how to take the medicine, you know? It's like, is it 3 pink pills in the morning and 1 blue pill in the afternoon and, you know, some orange pills at night, or the orange pills in the morning? And, you know, we forget what to do, yeah? Or sometimes the pills are kind of big and we can't take them. So we need mom to kind of, you know, or dad to, you know, squish them and put them in applesauce and say, open wide. You remember that? Yeah, did your parents do that? I couldn't swallow pills for anything when I was a kid. And I didn't like the applesauce with the pills in them either. But, you know, when it's Zoom, you don't have much choice. Yeah, so... So we need help along the path. We need help in practicing. We need encouragement. So the Sangha are the ones who encourage us. They're the ones who have actualized the path, who know the ultimate nature of reality. And so when we get stuck and we can't remember how to practice, or we get confused and we, you know, are unclear about what to do, then the Sangha steps in and helps us, just like nurses, you know, would help us take the pills, you know. And so then, as a patient with a good doctor, medicine, and nurses, then if we take the medicine, we get better. And so similarly, we will be able to liberate ourselves from cyclic existence and attain full awakening and really have the capacities to be of great benefit to living beings. Okay, so that's how it works, how our relationship with the three jewels, sometimes called the triple gem, same thing, how it works, okay? So people often ask, well, you know, do you have to have faith? Yeah. So faith is the word, you know, the Tibetan word depa, that is sometimes translated as faith, also can mean confidence or trust. And the English word faith is not a real good translation of that Tibetan word depa. Because often when we think of faith, we think of blind faith. You just believe because somebody said so, that's it. And you're not allowed to question. In Buddhism, it's very, very different. Yeah. In fact, I remember the first course I went to, the teachers said, don't believe anything we say, but examine it yourself. And, you know, test it logically, think about it. You know, don't just say, oh, I don't understand it or I don't like it and, you know, ignore it. But think about it. Look at it from different angles. Think about it with reasoning. Think about it in terms of personal experience, you know. And then also the different antidotes to the different mental afflictions, practice them and see if they work. And so if you think about things using reasoning and you practice them and have an experience yourself, then you know from your own experience and your own thought that something makes sense and it's reliable, and therefore you can have faith in it, therefore you trust it. Okay? So actually blind faith is very much discouraged within Buddhism. And the people who have blind faith, who just say, well, the Buddha's an enlightened being, so I believe whatever he said, those people are called the dull faculty disciples. Yeah, so it really isn't encouraged at all. And we're really taught, like I said, to think about it and practice it and, you know, determine for ourselves what the situation is. Okay? So when we talk about faith or trust or confidence in the three jewels, there can be three different kinds of faith. The first kind is we admire the qualities of the three jewels. Okay? So here, you know, you learn something about the qualities of the Buddha. So the Buddha is somebody who, through practicing and transforming their own mind, has no more ignorance, anger, and attachment. So that means that somebody who's a Buddha never gets angry. Okay? Now, I don't know about you, but when I sit and think about what would it be like to never get angry? Okay, think about that for a minute. Somebody could swear at you. Somebody could accuse you of doing something you didn't do. They could, you know, betray your trust and hurt your feelings. They could beat you or even kill you. No matter what they did, your mind's totally peaceful and there's no anger or hatred. What do you think? Would that be nice? I think it'd be very nice, you know. Not be such an emotional yo-yo, you know. I don't like this. I'm offended by what you said. Why did you do this? Just whatever people do. Okay? No anger inside. Okay? A Buddha is also somebody who is free of all clinging attachment, all greed, all of the mind that constantly wants more and better, more and better, that's dissatisfied, that's looking outside and grasping outside for happiness. Okay? So when I think, well, what would that be like not to have any clinging attachment? You know, there would be real freedom in the mind. All sorts of pleasant things could appear. I could enjoy them. And then when they're gone, I don't miss them. And I don't crave for them. Yeah. I'm not craving for anybody's approval, so I don't have to do 10 million backflips to try and please people who can never be pleased. Yeah. That would be really nice, wouldn't it? Okay. Or somebody who's totally, the Buddhist, somebody who's totally free from any kind of self-centered desire or thought, you know. But instead Buddha's mind automatically goes to what's of the greatest benefit to the greatest number of people. Yeah. So again, you know, that kind of mind, when I imagine what would it be like to have that kind of mind, again, whew, you know, quite a relief to be free of this self-centered thought that's always saying, but what about me? And what about my? What about mine? And I deserve this, and I'm entitled to that, and I'm number one, and nobody recognizes me, and I'm unappreciated, and I want more love, and, you know, all this. Ugh, we're so miserable by that self-centered thought, aren't we? You know? So to be free of that, and then to just naturally be interested and care about other people, that would be a really nice mental state. Yeah. So when I think of the qualities of a Buddha, I admire those qualities. Yeah. So that's the first kind of faith that we develop, you know, admiring faith, because we see the qualities and we think, whoa, they're nice, you know, and I can develop qualities like that, so I admire them. Yeah. And then the second kind of faith is aspiring faith, where you not just admire the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but you aspire to generate them yourself. So it's a kind of faith or trust that's mixed in with aspiring to generate those qualities ourselves. So in Buddhism, we don't just worship the Buddha, but we try to become like the Buddha. Okay? We don't try and please the Buddha or propitiate the Buddha, because the Buddha, from his side, doesn't need to be pleased. He's free of all self-centeredness. Yeah? So the Buddha isn't saying, okay, you offered me 4 pieces of fruit today. Well, I guess that's okay. You know? And a bunch of bowls of water. Okay. You know? So Buddha isn't sitting there kind of looking at what we offered and evaluating it and, you know, and we don't have to sing the praises of the Buddha because from the side of the Buddha he needs to be praised. You know, if we do chanting and reflect on the good qualities of the Buddha, it's because it uplifts our mind and helps our mind. But from the side of the Buddha has no need for any of that stuff. Yeah? I mean, if you're a fully enlightened being and you need some water and, you know, what is that, a pear or an apple or something, you know, to make you happy, and you need praise, then it seems to me you have some ego problems. Yeah? So, you know, in Buddhism that's not the case. All the offerings, the praises, the chanting we do is to transform our own mind, not because the Buddha is asking for it or needs it in any way. Okay, so we have admiring faith, we have aspiring faith, and then the third kind of faith, or trust, or confidence, is called convictional faith. In other words, we've thought about the teachings, and we've tried them out. You know, we've expanded our mind and really used reasoning, really looked at things in terms of our life experience. We haven't just looked at the teachings in a very narrow-minded way, through the veil of our own assumptions, but we've really tried to broaden our perspective and look at the teachings. And we found, like, oh, wow, what the Buddha says is true. You know, when I practice it, it helps me. And when I examine it with reasoning and logic, it, you know, it makes sense. And so therefore we have conviction. And because we have conviction in the teachings, then that leads to a certain kind of joy in the mind that is called faith. So it's called convictional faith, you know. We have faith based on conviction, and the conviction is based on reasoning and experience. And so the way that faith works with our practice is they really kind of go hand in hand and help each other. Because when we trust the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, our minds are much more open to listen to the teachings, to take them to heart, yeah, to think about them, to practice them. And then, of course, when we think about and practice them, you know, our mind gets clearer, And that clarity of mind and that resolution of different problems we've had then inspires us to have more confidence or more faith in the three jewels. And then that faith again makes our mind more open, more receptive. So when we listen to teachings, we take them in, we think about them more. And again, that thinking about them, contemplating them, generates more conviction, and then that increases, you know, our confidence. So you have wisdom and faith kind of as complementary things along the path that you cultivate together. Yeah. So it's definitely not this thing of I believe because the Buddha said. Okay. And so in ancient India, they had this tradition of doing debate about different spiritual viewpoints, different spiritual tenets. And that tradition was carried into Tibet. And so you'll see at the Tibetan nunneries and monasteries nowadays that the monastics will debate and really question the teachings. And, you know, they have really active debates, if you've ever seen it. They're quite lively. But it's really a tool to help us to learn to think clearly and to do the kind of investigation of things so that, you know, our mind is convinced through having wisdom. Okay? That's really quite important. Because if we haven't deeply thought about things and we just have faith because somebody's nice or something makes us feel good, then when somebody else comes along and teaches a different path, if that person's charismatic or what they say makes us feel good, then wham, you know, we dump Buddhism and, you know, practice another path or adopt another philosophy. So that kind of, you know, lack of clarity that underlies that is not something that's helpful to us. You know, we really, want to develop understanding. So that's very emphasized within the Buddhist path. So in the book, for each verse, I gathered stories from people from their own experience that illustrated kind of the meaning of the verse. So I thought to read you one or two of the stories here. Okay, so here's one. The person's story is called Stop Gravitating to Worldly Goals. Okay. So this person, I'll read you the story. It says, I've had a lot of worldly, in quotations, gods in my life. Mostly they came in the form of infatuations with emotionally unavailable people. Okay? So it's the idea of we take refuge. Taking refuge means we turn for guidance. We seek happiness. You know? So instead of seeking happiness in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, this person was seeking happiness in emotionally unavailable people. Anybody here done that? Okay, often they would be married. That presents a problem, doesn't it? Even if they were single, they were somehow emotionally unavailable. Still, I gravitated to them like a moth to a flame. At first, when I got the buzz of the attraction, I would think, this is it. This is the one. Sound familiar? And would feel so free and alive, not realizing that the freedom and the high were ways of distracting myself from my dissatisfied and often depressed mind. I would chase after these people in coy, silly ways. I would fantasize about them for hours each day, especially at the beginning of the relationship, when I hardly knew them. They seemed so perfect. We've all been there, haven't we? However, it didn't take long for me to shoot them out of the sky with my own unrealistic expectations. The misery I caused myself after I would stop seeing them was unbelievable. I was hoping for perfection, security, and romance, and what I got was misery and sorrow. Now when I feel lonely, I think of the Buddha as the perfect friend, somebody who actually has my best interest at heart. Yeah, because some of these, you know, romantic relationships with this perfect person, does that other person really have our best interests at heart? Do we have their best interests at heart? Or are we both in the process of, you know, trying to get the other one to fall for us? Okay. Knowing that I can entrust my heart and my deepest aspirations to the Buddha helps me relax and let go of my unrealistic stories about myself and others. It's like a true long-term healthy relationship where I can be myself and just relax and know that the Buddha will not leave or betray me. Because this one quality of the Buddha is that the Buddha, because the Buddha is totally free of attachment to some people and, you know, anger at others, so the Buddha doesn't play favorites. The Buddha has a mind of equanimity. And because a Buddha's cultivated the awareness of the kindness of others and the fact that everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer, then the Buddha has genuine open-hearted love, care, and concern for everybody and looks upon everybody equally with the eyes of acceptance, you know, which is so different from us because we look upon people with the eyes of judgment. Why are you doing that? Why are you wearing this? Why are you saying that? That's dumb. You know? I mean, we're constantly judging people. And to accept others, even to accept ourselves, is very difficult. Whereas a Buddha, you know, has this, you know, constant acceptance of self and others that's really beautiful. So there's no kind of judgment at all. You know? So this person says, I can be myself and just relax and know that the Buddha will not leave or betray me. It's all still new, and at times I feel awkward when I open my heart to the Buddha. Then I see that he already knows all about me and that his compassion and kindness won't end the matter how badly I behave. Furthermore, the Buddha isn't trying to make me emotionally dependent on him in an unhealthy way. His wish is for me to actualize my perfect Buddha potential and to benefit others. Who could ask for more? Okay, so that kind of is a personal story showing how somebody went from taking refuge just in ordinary people and external sense objects to having refuge and seeking spiritual guidance in someone who's reliable and in a path that's reliable and that has been tried and actualized over the centuries. Let me read you another story in this section too. So this one, I didn't meet the person who told this story. She wrote it to us, and she's Canadian. Okay, so she said, last year I was embroiled in a potentially dangerous and frightening situation when I tried to protect two dogs from being seized and euthanized by the authorities. The police arrested me for trying to stop this and handled me roughly. Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. They cuffed and leg shackled me, and something that was unnecessary to do to a woman who's almost 60 years old. I have never in my life been in a situation that even resembled this. I was thrown in a cold jail cell where my mind was filled with distress for the lives of the dogs and rage at the bullying by the police. I felt no fear at all for myself, which actually astonished me. All I knew was that I was going to be in that cell for a long time. I thought of the Tibetans experiencing similar but far worse treatment by police and realized how fortunate I was even in that situation. My grieving for the dogs was so painful that I needed to control it in order to stay well myself. While sitting on the floor and leaning against the wall, I stopped my tears, and for the first time in my life, I was tested to truly, truly go for refuge to the Three Jewels. In such a tumultuous mental state, I was not able to visualize anything but His Holiness the Dalai Lama sitting in front of me, exchanging breaths. Reciting Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of great compassion, my very being pleaded this mantra, you know, compassion, compassion. There was no rote recitation here. I was desperate in wanting to be compassionate. That began at about 10:45 in the morning. After a short time, I calmly wondered what time it was as I heard talking outside. It was 12:30 at night. In 30 years of Dharma practice, I have never experienced so intensely the power of sincerely taking refuge in the Three Jewels. Beautiful story, huh? Okay. So we have a little bit of time if you have some questions or comments.
Not remembering the exact story about the Buddha talking about pointing somewhere and don't focus on the pointing.
Yeah.
That's a teaching.
Yeah, okay. So there's actually the painting that's right by your side is that painting is of the Wheel of Life. In the upper right corner you should see the Buddha. It might be under the yellow cloth there. But you should see the Buddha there pointing, and then on the left side of the picture is the moon. So the Buddha's pointing to the moon. You see it? So what that's indicating is that that painting is talking about the Wheel of Life, how our mind under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment keeps finding, you know, getting ourselves into one rebirth after the other with a lot of difficulties. The Buddha is outside that circle and he's pointing to the moon. The moon is representing liberation or nirvana. Okay. But he said, don't keep looking at me and my finger. You have to look at what I'm pointing to the moon. In other words, don't just worship me and look at me, but put it, you know, put your aim on achieving the results of the path and do the practice that will lead you to liberation. So that's the meaning of the how it's described. Okay.
How did the Buddhists perceive Jesus?
How does the Buddhist perceive Jesus? As somebody who is very kind, very compassionate, putting it, Jesus, you know, the figure of Jesus into Buddhist language, we may say he was a bodhisattva, somebody who has deep love and compassion for all living beings and who aspires for full awakening. So, you know, definitely would have respect for Jesus and Jesus' message. Okay. I think a lot of the problem today is that many people don't practice their own religion well. And I think if, you know, and I think if Jesus showed up here, he would be horrified in what is done in his name. You know?
In the story of the woman in jail taking refuge in the Three Treasures for over 12 hours, at first she could only picture the Buddha, and the Sangha wouldn't be there. Would that be memories of the Sangha? Mm-hmm. And would the Dharma be thinking of all the teachings?
Yeah, in her specific case, you know, she was She said all she could see was like His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Oh, right, that's what
yeah. And he, for her, embodied the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Oh.
All three together embodied in His Holiness. And then when she was reciting Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of great compassion, she realized that she needed to change her own mind to a mind of compassion in order to endure this ordeal. Yeah. And so with her fervent, wish to transform her mind, really placing it like that, in taking refuge, then that's what happened. Mm-hmm.
She obviously, in that story, did some actions on her own to precipitate being shackled and landing in jail. She wasn't an innocent bystander, but she precipitated the situation and then was able to transform her perceptions enough dramatically in a short period of time is what I got out of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't know exactly what she did. Because
but it had to be something, obviously, to
something,
get that kind of attention.
Yeah, although we have many stories of police acting inappropriately. So, it's hard. Something happened, we don't know to what degree or what it
but
was.
But it gives you confidence that when you have operated inappropriately and gotten yourself, which we all do, into situations we'd rather not be in,
right,
that you can then, through your own self-examination or wisdom, extricate yourself from that and then change.
Yes, exactly.
That is the power of that story to me.
Yeah, exactly. The power of the mind. Yeah, the power of the mind.
Changing yourself.
Yes.
And walk from one extreme situation to the other in a short period of time.
Right, right. Yeah. A situation. Who knows what she did, but she was obviously upset and angry. And then the way the police handled her made her more upset and angry. But then, that's very much what Buddhism is about transforming our mental state. Because at the end of the day, we can't control the external world. We keep trying to, but we can't. So the only thing at the end of the day that we can change is inside here. And so that's exactly what she did. Yeah?
I don't know if I completely understood you in terms of the word Sangha. Uh-huh. I did not realize am I understanding that means only realized beings? Mm. I thought that people coming together who were in process were also called Sangha.
Okay, so there's different ways in which the word Sangha is used. The Sangha that we take refuge in has got to be realized beings. Yeah? There's no sense in taking refuge in an individual who is not realized, because they can't guide us. So the Sangha jewel that we take refuge in is a realized being. The representative of the Sangha jewel is a community of four or more fully ordained monastics. Okay? So it's not even one monastic. It's got to be a community. Because when there's a community, there's a certain energy that happens, and the community does certain practices together that build certain energy. So that's four more fully ordained, not even the novices, but fully ordained monastics. In the West, not in Asia, definitely not in Asia, but in the West, the word Sangha is often used for anybody who comes to a Buddhist center. Personally speaking, I think that's very confusing. That's a Western anomaly, because then many people who come to the center aren't even Buddhists. Many of the people who come to the center, even who have been practicing, haven't even taken the five precepts. Yeah? So the five precepts are to abandon killing, stealing, unkind or unwise sexual contact, lying, and intoxicants. So people coming to a Buddhist center may or may not even have taken those, so they may still engage in those actions. So it's confusing, therefore, to say, I take refuge in the Sangha, meaning everybody who comes to a center. Yeah? So that's why I personally refer to everybody who comes to the center as the Buddhist community. Yeah, I think that's much clearer. You know, that's the Buddhist community of practitioners. The Sangha we take refuge in are the realized beings. The representation is a community of four more fully ordained monastics.
Thank you.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Prana and I were talking about this the other day. Is Buddhism a religion or not a religion, and why or why not?
Okay, yeah, this comes up a lot. Is Buddhism a religion or not, and why or why not? It depends on what you define as a religion. Yeah? It just completely, you know, depends on that. But for some people, religion means theistic religion. You know, if religion in your mind is something that has to believe in a creator, then Buddhism wouldn't be a religion. If religion means a system of practice leading to liberation or to spiritual realizations, then Buddhism would be a religion. So it depends on, like everything, how you define something. Yeah. Okay, let's sit quietly. We can sit quietly and reflect for a couple of minutes on what we heard.